As many of you know, we announced a new partnership with Blue Shield and Kaiser as third-party administrators. On February 15th, we will have that contract made public. Details of that will be put out. Two nonprofits, no profit in this process, all about logistics, warehousing, all about making sure the equity friends frame is advanced, and there's provider accountability across the spectrum.
Governor Gavin Newsom at the Oakland Coliseum 2 weeks ago, promising details of a vaccine distribution partnership would be unveiled this week. Well, now the contract with Blue Shield is public. The goal is to administer 3 million shots a week starting next month. We're going to talk through some of the details now with Melody Gutierrez. She's a state government and politics reporter at the LA Times, and she's been following this closely. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. So the Kaiser contract is not public, but the Blue Shield one is. And what did you learn looking at that?
Right. So in the Blue Shield contract, we can see that they will create an algorithm that will determine how COVID vaccines will be allocated. It also gives a lot of leeway to Blue Shield in determining who, what providers, what counties will be able to be allocated these supplies. So it'll be a complete shakeup of the current system to centralize it and then improve the data functions of how the system is currently working, which is one of the biggest complaints.
So Blue Shield will determine who gets how many doses?
Yes, exactly. The state will have some oversight of that and can overrule Blue Shield, but Blue Shield will largely be given the authority to determine who will be allocated these doses that the state gets in and how those will be moved across the state in an effort to sort of pinpoint geographical areas as well as high needs areas where these vaccines will go.
And the current system is that counties get to decide who gets the vaccine and where.
Right. So counties currently, the state pushes out to counties and the counties then move those vaccines across the needs in their individual areas.
So how are the counties reacting to this?
You know, a lot of them are unhappy that they say that the current problem with vaccines is mostly related to supply. Blue Shield coming in does not affect how many doses the state gets from the federal government. It simply just changes the system and how the state is divvying them up. So counties are not happy. I talked to Board of Supervisor Holly Mitchell yesterday, and she was saying that this is worrisome to her, that there's still a lot of murkiness in terms of what this algorithm will produce and where these doses will be sent.
And what problem is this trying to solve? What problem does Gavin Newsom see, and why did he want Blue Shield to take this over?
There's a couple issues. The lack of available doses doesn't change, but that is the biggest issue with vaccines right now. But it centralizes a system that is very fragmented. So you will see a lot of pulling together there and having one entity deciding, you know, where the need is versus it being distributed to counties and then counties deciding where the need is. So the hope is that pulling it to become this central system, that it'll help divvy them up and get them where they need to go faster. In addition, the hope is that the contract with Blue Shield will help with some of the data issues that have completely plagued this program.
And talk about that a little bit, because there's a problem with the data in terms of how many people got the vaccine, right? So the state doesn't have an accurate tally?
Right. The data issues are pretty far-reaching. So it goes from everything from omitted doses. You know, counties are saying that they upload their data into the state's immunization registry and then are told that they're uploaded and get confirmation that they're uploaded and then only later find out they were not uploaded. You also have uploading errors in different ways. You have lag times where people who are administering the vaccines are not either submitting their data or the software itself is creating a lag time that does not allow the state in real time to see just how many doses are out there. So when you're looking at the state system and it's saying that the state has, you know, early on, especially in the pandemic, it was saying that with the vaccines that they were not being released in a timely manner. It looked like a lot of people were sitting on these doses, as Governor Newsom had said at one point. But the data itself is so lagging that it's hard to see where how many doses have been administered to date.
And as you said, it's unclear exactly what this algorithm does.
The algorithm, according to the contract, does not look like it's been written yet. And Whether that algorithm will be released to the public for, you know, full vetting, I'm unclear on that as well. But certainly it'll have wide impacts on the vaccine rollout and where vaccines are going. So this is going to be a huge issue that will be left to an algorithm that has yet to be released.
Right. So in the meantime, the counties will still be administering the vaccine?
In the meantime, the counties will continue to administer the vaccine until the programs hit their particular areas.
And they don't have a choice in it. I know Ventura County said that it doesn't want to be a part of this, but it has to?
Yes, exactly. There is no opt-out function, despite several counties asking for that, including Ventura.
And then separately, Kaiser will have its own system. So there'll be two separate systems?
There will be two systems in a way. Mostly it's a program run by Blue Shield with a carve out for Kaiser, is how I'm kind of phrasing that. Is Kaiser will run its own program within its own hospitals and as well as some mass vaccination sites. But for the most part, it's Blue Shield that will run it statewide with a carve out for Kaiser.
And will that be just for their members or for other people too?
They'll serve other people, but they'll do their members, and then they'll serve additional people through the mass vaccination sites. I mean, they were just given like 180,000 vaccines recently, like to go into disproportionately hit communities. And neither of these companies are companies that are known to serve, you know, low income communities. So this is a huge task where that's the communities that they're being asked to go into, is to find the uninsured, but you're going to two insurance companies to find the uninsured.
Now, Blue Shield and the governor say they're not making any money off this. Is that true?
Right. So the letters of intent with both Blue Shield and Kaiser said that they would make this at cost and that this would not be a money-making venture for either companies. The contract with Blue Shield that was released did say that the Blue Shield would run it at cost and that they could bill the state for no more than $15 million over the term of the contract, which ends December 31st, and that would be for their own out-of-pocket costs.
Now, I know Blue Shield has been a prolific donor to Governor Newsom and to some of his issues that he has promoted. Blue Shield isn't making any money off this, but can they benefit from this in any way politically?
I think any company that's seen as stepping forward for the greater good during the pandemic, whether it be altruistic or not, will be seen in a positive light. So there's certainly that. But how much they make by their contracts with this and the relationships that they're building. So the long-term impact, I think, is still unclear of how it benefits Blue Shield. And that's certainly something we'll continue to be watching.
Melody Gutierrez from the LA Times, thank you.
Thank you.
LA County announced last night that elementary schools can now reopen. The county hit the metric of 25 infections or fewer per 100,000 people, allowing them to lift the restrictions on in-person learning. Not all schools are reopening, though. LAUSD says it will not reopen elementary schools until enough teachers and staff can be vaccinated. But the news is being welcomed in other L.A. area school districts, and we're going to talk about how one school is handling the news now. Tom Conjoyan is the head of the Village Christian School in Sun Valley. It's a K-12 school of about 1,100 students. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's great to be part of this.
Well, I understand you were part of a caravan yesterday of school leaders and parents calling on the county to allow reopening, like a protest. And, well, it happened. So how do you feel about that?
Oh, it was great. I've been a part of an organization called Students First Coalition, which is a coalition of private schools, the American Academy of Pediatrics, parent groups, and even a few public school groups who have wanted to have a voice in the discussion about when we're going to reopen schools here in LA County. And because we're not LAUSD, we felt like our voice was not being heard. And so we've been meeting together with the Department of Health, trying to push for greater openings of schools based on science and data. And we decided yesterday to hold a car rally, which harkened back to the way our kids had to graduate last year because they weren't allowed to have in-person graduations. They had car parades. But we also knew it was a safe way for our teachers and our parents to voice their support for schools to open.
Now, I understand you have already opened your elementary grades. You received a waiver, so they've been open since November. So what does this mean practically for you?
There's two programs currently available to schools in LA County. One is the waiver program, which we received back in November for TK through second grade. And then the other one's a cohorting program, which allows small groups of students to learn who are experiencing learning issues. And so at our school, we had applied both the TK through two waiver to open those grades, and then the cohorting program to open our third through fifth grades. So the current ruling doesn't impact us a lot, but it lets us apply some of those cohorting strategies to another population of our school, our older students.
But there are some significant challenges, as we've heard. LAUSD is not going to do this because teachers aren't vaccinated. You need to maintain 6 feet of distance, right, between each student. As you said, you have to have small learning pods, better ventilation. How are these schools going to implement all this?
Yeah, it's very challenging. So the schools in our coalition, and I would argue most of the private schools and even many of the public school districts in California and LA, we prepared all summer to reopen our schools under the guidelines we received from the CDC, the county, and the state. So that meant investing in all of the health and safety protocols, the PPE, reconfiguring our classrooms for less students, making sure that we had distancing. We all built outdoor classrooms because we knew that was better for students and our employees. And so we've been prepared for this for months now, and we weren't able to implement those measures because the County of Los Angeles was the only county in America in the fall to not allow kids to go back to school. So we're ready to do it from that perspective. It does make, because of the distancing, it does ensure that you can't bring all your kids back. So you have to do a hybrid type of format so that you have half your kids at school and half your kids at home. But our parents are so desperate to get their kids back to in-person learning that they have been more than willing to put up with all of the different protocols we've had to be put into place to get kids here on campus.
What about the teachers and the staff? Are they worried that if they're not vaccinated, that this could be dangerous for them?
Well, our teachers really believe that their mission is to help kids learn, and they know that online learning, as hard as it's been for our teachers, and believe me, they are heroes. They've been incredibly adaptive and creative in changing their entire way of doing their work to an online format this year. But they know in-person is so much better for kids. And so they are willing to do it. Of course, they would love to be vaccinated. They feel like the county once again has deprioritized teachers from vaccinations. They were supposed to be second in line after healthcare workers, and now they're way, way back in the line because of the county making decisions to allow seniors and now people with medical health issues to jump in front of them. But they're still willing to teach because they've seen all the mountains of research and data from schools across the country and across the world who have reopened, and they have not had the transmission or the spread of the virus in school settings. So they believe if we follow the key mitigation strategies that we can do this safely.
Hmm. That's a state decision, though, right, to change who's prioritized for the vaccine?
Yeah, it was a state decision. And then from what I understand, the supervisors of the County of Los Angeles decided to align with the state and move teachers down the list.
And so the teachers haven't said to you, we really don't want to go back into the classroom until we're vaccinated.
No, they are willing to come back in the classroom. Like I said, because we've had the waiver and the cohorting, they've been back in the classroom since November. Yeah. And so They know it's safe. We have not had any spread at our schools. And if you ask any of the schools in the coalition who have been back under the waiver program or cohorting, none of us have had any spread of the virus in our schools. Of course, you can still get the virus. We're not saying that. But we're saying that it doesn't spread through kids in the schools like people are afraid of, at least not more than it does in the community.
So what happens if the infection rate goes up past the 25 per 100,000 and things have to shut down again?
That's a good question. The way the state has told us and the way they've acted is that once you're able to reopen, they don't close you down again. So, for example, the schools in Orange County and Ventura County and San Diego County who were able to reopen when their counties were down in the red tier, they've remained open throughout this whole period of time, even when their rates in their county went up into the purple tier. So that's our understanding, is they will not shut us down again. Now, of course, if things get completely out of control like they were in January, maybe if a regional stay-at-home order or something dramatic was enacted, maybe they would shut schools down again. But from our understanding is they have not done that in the state of California yet.
Well, thanks so much for coming on the show today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. That's Tom Kanjoyan. He's the head of school at Village Christian in Sun Valley. Coming up, former President Donald Trump faces civil litigation accusing him of inciting the January 6th insurrection. The Legal Eagle, Jessica Levinson, explains next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, he may have avoided conviction in the Senate, but Donald Trump's legal worries are far from over. He's now facing a civil lawsuit related to the insurrection. The NAACP, on behalf of a Mississippi Democratic congressman, is suing Trump and his personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani. The Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers are also named. The suit claims they all conspired to block the certification of the presidential election on January 6th by inciting the riots. And they're citing a 19th century law called the Ku Klux Klan Act. Jessica Levinson is here to talk about this. She's a law professor at Loyola Law School and a regular Legal Eagle. Hi.
Hi.
Well, I just want to start by playing a clip of tape of Republican Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, who said this about his decision to vote against conviction.
President Trump is still liable for everything he did while he was in office as an ordinary citizen. Unless the statute of limitations is run, still liable for everything he did while he's in office. Didn't get away with anything yet. We have a criminal justice system in this country. We have civil litigation. And former presidents are not immune from being accountable by either one.
So, Jessica, it actually sounds like he's encouraging people to file lawsuits. And is this one that we're about to talk about, is this an example of what he's talking about?
It could be. I read him as encouraging that the Senate move on and encouraging support for his decision not to vote to convict. But yes, I mean, what he's saying is faces legal exposure. And so this is not the end of the road. And this is one of the first suits that we've seen. It's a civil suit in federal district court using a very old federal civil rights law passed in the 1870 and 1871, essentially to try and enforce the 14th Amendment. So I think that this is part of what he was talking about, which is basically, okay, open up the floodgates. There'll be criminal investigations, there'll be civil suits, and somebody else go ahead and deal with this.
Well, let's talk about this one in particular. And you said that it does rely on this 19th century law, the Ku Klux Klan Act. What is that?
Yeah, so this was an act that was, it's basically the enforcement acts of the 14th Amendment and the 13th Amendment and the 15th Amendment. And it prohibits, in the case that we're talking about, it prohibits violence or intimidation that's meant to prevent Congress from doing its constitutional duties or other federal officials from carrying out their constitutional duties. Essentially, the Ku Klux Klan was intimidating members of Congress, other federal officials, preventing them from doing their jobs. And this statute says, you know what, under the 14th Amendment, you're not prohibited from doing that. And it will be a federal crime and or can lead to federal civil liability if you do try and use violence or intimidation to prevent your member of Congress from doing something that they're constitutionally required to do. In this case, what's constitutionally required? Certifying the Electoral College vote.
What does the lawsuit say about Donald Trump and Rudy Giuliani conspiring with these groups, the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers?
Well, it says just that. So it's interesting because the impeachment really focused on just incitement of the insurrection. And this suit is actually broader. The suit says also what we want to talk about is everything that happened before, not just that speech on January 6th, but let's be very clear that that was not an isolated incident. Let's be very clear that for months before the election, you said this election is going to be stolen. Then after the election, you said this election was stolen. And you said, what's the solution to that? The solution is to fight. So it kind of zooms out on the president's conduct. And it says, look, who were you talking with? Who did you have a tacit agreement with? Your personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani. And you use these right-wing extremist groups to try and further your goal. So it's a version of the impeachment in terms of the sense that we're still talking about the insurrection, but it's also a broader view of all the behavior, and it sweeps in some new characters.
And what is the significance of using this particular statute? Couldn't you file a lawsuit just based on, insurrection and inspiring that insurrection, inspiring violence? Do you need to have this? Do you need to attach this 19th century law?
So I think that the significance is essentially twofold. So on the one hand, it's saying it's not just that you incited violence, but look at what you tried to do. You tried to prohibit Congress from doing its job. And the other thing it does is it very clearly situates this behavior as challenging the voices of racial minorities. It very clearly says, look, we know which votes you didn't want to count. You didn't want to count the votes of people who were disproportionately in communities of color. So it situates the alleged conduct as part of a larger struggle for racial equality. And the insurrection, just using the federal insurrection law, can't do that.
How do you think the courts will handle this based on the fact that this is a former president we're talking about?
Well, so a couple of things. One, it's good news that I don't have a definitive answer for you because we don't want to use this act very often, right? We want this to be extremely rare, just like we want impeachment to be extremely rare. You know, two, what would a court say? Well, let's think about what President Trump's defenses are. His defenses are essentially, one, I didn't incite an insurrection. I said things like peacefully. Two, he'll say, look, I was president when I did those things, and I have broad executive protections. And then the third thing I think he'll say is, I was engaging in political speech, and we have a very strong tradition in our country of not punishing political speech. So that was, I guess, a way of dodging your question and saying that's what a court's going to be balancing. On the one hand, the allegation, and then on the other hand, I think these three kind of buckets of defenses that President Trump will bring forth.
Right. But it's a different, as you just alluded to, a different accusation when it comes to Rudy Giuliani and which votes he was targeting votes in urban centers with a very large minority population voting. And so that's sort of a different idea than a free speech argument. And so would the bar be lower also because he's not a former president?
I think Rudy Giuliani, for a whole host of reasons that you just talked about, does not face the same or does not enjoy the same potential protections. Of course, he wasn't the president. He was the president's attorney. And I think he could still try and put forward something, some attenuated version of a free speech argument. But for him, I think it's both potentially weaker with respect to the actual allegations, and then also his defenses are weaker. And remember, there are certain protections for attorneys who are speaking on behalf of their clients. So while he can't say, I have protection because I was president, he can say, I have a protection because I was acting as an official attorney.
Jessica Levinson, she teaches law at Loyola Law School, and she's our regular Legal Eagle here on Press Play. Thanks, Jessica. Come coming up, for a period in 1985, Los Angeles was terrorized by a serial killer. He was caught by regular citizens.
And it becomes this, I think, beautiful poetic justice that as he's preying on the fears of the city and the kind of nightmares of them all throughout this summer, it's the city itself that grabs him in the end.
The director of a new Netflix series on the Night Stalker is here next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, if you lived in L.A. in the 1980s, these two words may be triggering.
The Night Stalker.
Today, the search for California's Night Stalker
the
continues.
The so-called Night Stalker murders in California.
Californians have come to know him as the Night Stalker.
The Night Stalker, his real name, Richard Ramirez, a serial killer who murdered more than a dozen people and terrorized Los Angeles for months in 1985.
With Maria Hernandez, he could have walked up behind her in silence and killed her. He didn't. He intentionally slapped the top of a car so that she could turn around and see him. Dale Okazaki, she was down on the ground, and he waited until he saw the fear in her eyes. Then he shot her.
That's Gil Carrillo, one of two L.A. County Sheriff's homicide detectives who cracked the case. He and his partner, Frank Salerno, are profiled in a new Netflix docuseries. It's called Night Stalker, The Hunt for a Serial Killer. And the director, Tiller Russell, joins me now. Hi.
Hey there. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Well, take us back to L.A. in the summer of 1985. This is, well, a year after the Olympics had taken place, so L.A. was pretty proud of itself. Remind us what the city was like back then. What did it look like?
Well, you know, I think the thing that most people remember most vividly from that summer is that it was this incredibly long, hot summer. And, you know, you're in the aftermath of Fernando Valenzuela, Dodger mania, and the Lakers, and there's sort of all of this Los Angeles pride and the kind of unbridled enthusiasm of, you know, the Reagan 80s. And then into that context comes this horrifying story, and which was this serial killer preying on citizens throughout the Southland.
Right. And citizens throughout the Southland, but also in a particular area, right? Like mainly in the San Gabriel Valley and San Fernando Valley.
Yeah. Well, what was interesting about it is, what made it so challenging, I think, for law enforcement is that these were seemingly patternless crimes. So the victims ranged in age from, you know, 6 to 82. There were men, there were women, there were children, there were different murder weapons that were used, there were guns, there were knives. And the randomness of those attacks was also mirrored in some sense by the randomness of how they were scattered across the city. So as the attacks are taking place, they're in different police jurisdictions, which instantaneously made it incredibly difficult for law enforcement to track because one department doesn't know what another department is doing.
Right. And so two detectives are on this pretty much full time, and you focus on them, and they are Gil Carrillo and Frank Salerno. Frank Salerno was already sort of a celebrity, right? Because he had solved the Hillside Strangler serial killer case.
He was homicide cop royalty from having solved the Hillside Strangler, and was this kind of illustrious and revered figure in the department. And he ended up getting paired with this young Latino rookie, Gil Carrillo, who at the time was one of the youngest members to ever make homicide. And so it became this unlikely pairing of the grizzled veteran and the young buck working this kind of once-in-a-lifetime horrifying case.
So how did Gil Carrillo get on this case if he was a young buck?
Well, he had made the homicide unit, which is, they called them the Bulldogs back then for the sheriff's department. And he had, you know, coming out of the gang unit in East L.A., had made homicide. And so, and was one of the youngest people ever in the history of the department to do so. And what happens is you just catch a case as you're sitting there at the desk and a call comes in. Okay, there's been a murder at such and such location. And in this case, it was the murder of Dale Okazaki in the attack on Maria Hernandez. And so Gil catches that case and responds to the call. And when he does, he walks into this, you know, horrifying murder scene. And unbeknownst to him, it's the beginning of a series of murders, a serial killer preying on Los Angeles. And he just wandered into it, just like everybody else, the kind of randomness, and caught the case.
Hmm. Right. So let me play a clip of tape of him talking about how they kept gathering evidence here and there, but never quite solving the case.
Frank had been through serial killer before. And I remember leaving the Hall of Justice one day asking him if it was wrong for me to want somebody else to die. I needed more evidence. I needed him to screw up. And the only way he'd make a mistake was if there were more victims.
So that's kind of creepy. And so that must have weighed on him, right? That he really, really wanted to catch the killer, but he couldn't do it unless there were more murders.
Yeah, it's the complicated moral calculus of working homicide. You know, the only way, and you have to remember, this is pre-DNA, right? And it's actually even precedes the existence of a computerized fingerprint database. So everything was being worked in the kind of old school, analog, old fashioned way. And so it really became a series of, the only way that you could get the next clue, the next piece of information, was by waiting for another body to drop. And so, you know, particularly for somebody that is, you know, a deeply religious guy, you know, Catholic, and a family man himself, you know, with a wife and multiple kids, it was a heavy moral weight for him, having to chase in the wake of death to solve the case.
And they have some very near misses, like they almost catch him a couple of times. Can you talk about what happened with the dentist?
Yeah, well, it was interesting. What they initially found, a car was impounded, and inside of that car, there was a dental appointment, a card for a dental appointment. And so they were able to, you know, triangulate the fact that Richard Ramirez, who they knew, didn't know at the time who he was, they just knew it was the Night Stalker, this killer that was out there, had an impacted tooth. And so it was going to be a matter of time before he showed up at the dentist. So they end up setting up 24-hour surveillance and stakeouts. And then, unfortunately, just before being able to apprehend him, they pull people off because he hasn't shown up in the period of time. And then as soon as they pull people off, in walks Ramirez, you know, to get the tooth removed. And then frantically, the dentist is calling the department, like, why weren't you guys here? And so, again, it was another one of those, one of several instances where the Night Stalker slipped through the grasp of those detectives.
Mm. Right. And then he leaves the city and goes up to San Francisco, where he attacks a couple in their 60s. He killed the husband. He left the wife for dead. And investigators, they find that it's the same type of ballistics and shoe print evidence as the crime scenes in Los Angeles. So here is the mayor at the time, who is now our senator, Dianne Feinstein, holding a press conference about the killing.
Everybody, please closely study this composite. He's someone that will go into a home at night and will kill. Ballistics on the weapons that killed both Mr. and Mrs. Pan out on eucalyptus over the weekend are the same ballistics on, I understand, more than a dozen murders committed in Southern California.
Right. So then it becomes a much bigger case. I mean, you said earlier that there were multiple law enforcement agencies involved. Well, now there are multiple parts of the state and their law enforcement agencies involved. How did that complicate the case for Carrillo and Salerno?
Well, you have all of these conflicting entities, right? And everybody is essentially just trying to do their own job, but they're brought into conflict. And it began sort of initially with, you know, the cops and the media, where the media feels rightly, hey, we have an obligation to let the public know what's going on in these city and what's going on with these murders. Well, at the same time, if they expose vital information of the investigation, it could potentially delay the apprehension of the killer. Well, then as the scope of the case expands from Los Angeles to San Francisco, suddenly the mayor takes it on and she's like, I have to warn people. Here's the relevant information. I'm going to broadcast this. But what she didn't necessarily realize at the time is that she's broadcasting critical information that only the killer would be aware of. And so once that's put out there, then the killer will change his MO, stop using a certain weapon, stop using the shoes that tie him together to these multiple victims, and it jeopardizes the investigation. But I think none of it out of ill will. Everybody's just trying to do what they think is right in a terrifying situation.
And did it, in fact, do that? Did he, in fact, change his MO?
Well, you know, it's fascinating. One of the signature pieces of evidence that tied all these cases together, he was wearing a very rare shoe. Avia at the time was a new manufacturer that had just started making these shoes, and there were a very small number of them that were used. And in repeated murder scenes, there were footprints of this very unique sole pattern of the Avia that were there. And suddenly, when that information was shared in that press conference, as well as information about the ballistics, so the story goes that from that day forward, the Avias never appeared again. And so that one critical piece of evidence that linked them all together then disappeared afterwards.
But Carrillo and Salerno, they keep working the case, and then they finally get an ID. How did they do that? How did they finally figure out it was Ramirez?
Well, it's interesting. It becomes this constellation of different law enforcement agencies and cops that are working together on this. And it's actually a San Francisco. There's an informant in Southern California whose information coincides with that of a police inspector in San Francisco, and they're able to connect with one of Ramirez's running buddies, this tough, hard-bitten San Francisco cop, squares away and threatens to, bang him over the head. And this guy coughs up the name Richard Ramirez. And from that confession from his, crime partner, we get the name Richard Ramirez, which then they're able to pull a photo ID, a booking photo. And then that iconic booking photo ends up getting published in the paper and, seen all over the world and certainly all over the city in California when that iconic booking photo comes out.
Right. And I think my favorite part in this four-part series of yours is when he is identified by citizens. Like, citizens are the ones who catch him. LA is in terror. Everyone's afraid that some guy is going to come through their window and kill them. And let's just play a clip from your movie where East LA residents describe their pursuit of him, because he's at one point running down the streets from the cops.
Got a metal stick from right there from the gate, hit him in the head.
I gave him one by the car, the man fell, he started running away, I chased him, then I gave him another hit.
All the neighbors chased him down the street.
You know, I say, oh my God, that's the guy.
He said something in Spanish about, I'm lucky the cops are coming or something. Because he knew that everybody was going to finish him.
So he was actually desiring, he actually wanted the cops to come because he was afraid the people were going to kill him?
There's a poetic justice to it that, like, if you were to have made this story up and if you were in a writer's room pitching it, you would be fired. People would tell you, like, that's preposterous. The city's never going to rise up and capture the serial killer that's been terrorizing them for this entire long, hot summer. But because it's true, it ends up feeling like, wow, this is a kind of a gift from the cinema gods in terms of the storytelling. And it becomes this, I think, beautiful poetic justice that as he's preying on the fears of the city and the kind of nightmares of them all throughout this summer, it's the city itself that grabs him in the end.
Wow, that's a nice way of putting it. The city itself grabs him in the end. And what about his psychology? What was it that made him do this? Is it understandable at all?
I asked this question to every single person that I came in contact with, to the cops, to victims, to, the reporters who covered it, to everybody that was involved in the story. And there's no clear consensus. There's no explanation for it because the acts are of such profound evil that it's hard to kind of justify it in human terms.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Like, you never know what makes people psychotic in that way. Do you ever think, gosh, I worry that this documentary series might inspire someone to do some of this themselves?
Well, it was a strong cautionary note that we entering into this that it was a critical decision to focus on the cops and the victims and not focus on Ramirez, because there is this tendency for whatever reason in our culture to sort of adore celebrities for whatever reason. You know, it can be the worst thing in the world. But what I wanted to do with this, you know, most people know Ramirez is a serial killer. What they don't know is that he was also, you know, a pedophile and a rapist of children. And that is a crucial piece of the story that we tell, because those cases were never ended up being prosecuted because they didn't want to re-traumatize the kids that had lived through them. But I think it's important for people to confront, you know, that's impossible to glamorize no matter who you are. And so that was a really critical piece of the story that we wanted to shine a light on to prevent exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah. Well, it is fascinating, and it was terrifying and yet compelling to live through that again through Netflix. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Tiller Russell, director of the new Netflix series Night Stalker, The Hunt for a Serial Killer. Coming up, you've probably seen those viral videos of UCLA gymnasts doing their floor routines. We'll talk to the choreographer of those routines next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, outside of the Olympics, a lot of us don't pay a lot of attention to gymnastics competitions. But the UCLA women's team makes it a habit of breaking through the public's usual indifference. Specifically, Nia Dennis, who has yet another routine that's gone viral. The 21-year-old senior flipped, sprang, and grew to a mix of hit songs from Black artists like Missy Elliott, Kendrick Lamar, and Tupac. Well, that routine scored her a near-perfect 10 and a supportive tweet from former First Lady Michelle Obama. It wasn't the first time one of her routines went viral. Last year, her routine to a Beyoncé medley got similar attention. Behind both these routines is dancer and choreographer Bijoya Das. And Das is a volunteer assistant coach for UCLA Gymnastics. Her choreography is a mix of traditional gymnastics moves and dance trends you might see on TikTok. It is an unmistakable style, which just keeps winning. Bijoya Das, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, first of all, your title, it's because of some obscure NCAA rules, right, that you're a volunteer, you're not paid?
It is, yes. I am paid for running the recreational program at UCLA and doing summer camps, but I am not paid for my work with the UCLA gymnastics team.
So how did you get involved?
I have always been inspired by this team. I was actually a collegiate gymnast myself, and I always looked up to UCLA. They've recruited Olympians for decades now, and they were always known for their fun floor choreography. And so when I started getting into dance, you know, I completely stepped away from the world of gymnastics. But as I saw that college gymnastics evolved and it got bigger and performance became like even more important, I just had to get back into it in a different way. And I think the culture that they've set up at UCLA of really integrating dance and gymnastics has kind of what attracted me back into the sport.
Right. And not a lot of teams do this, right? UCLA is a standout.
I think we are definitely at the forefront of it. I think other teams are kind of following suit as well, just because it's fun and it really brings a wider audience to watching mm-hmm. the sport. But yeah, I think we definitely have a bit of fearlessness when it comes to just trying things that aren't very traditional in the sport of gymnastics.
Right. Well, let's talk about that routine that Michelle Obama loved so much and we all loved so much that Nia Dennis did. How did that come about, the idea for that, the music and the choreography?
So Nia's routine last year, it was to a Beyonce medley. That one went viral as well.
What a fun routine.
Fabulous.
That was just all fun. And she can just turn her personality on and let it shine, the whole routine.
There's a bit of pressure, I think, coming into her senior year, just because it's her last year of gymnastics, and we really wanted to go out with a bang. We were just like, okay, it's your senior year. What are you going to do? What do you want to say? And what was going on at the time, it was right around the Black Lives Matter protests, and the George Floyd incident, we wanted to say something, and we weren't sure how that was going to look like, because, you know, in gymnastics, you obviously aren't able to use your voice in the same way, but we wanted the music to reflect Black culture, Black excellence, and make a statement in some way. And so we really just started with songs that spoke to her and that represented Black culture and really just who she is as a woman. Mm-hmm. And we narrowed it down. I mean, it was about 85 songs on my Spotify list. You know, 8 volumes of the mix later, we finally arrived at that perfect one. We brought the Tupac song in at the last moment, and that was kind of the thing that I think sealed the deal and just made it feel like this complete story of celebrating Black culture.
Oh, yeah. And then how do you work out the choreography to go with it? Do you do it together? Do you come up with the dance moves and she learns them? How does that work?
The process is kind of different for each athlete. Nia, I would say, is definitely more collaborative usually. I had spent some time with the music in my studio, just like working out some ideas. And then I kind of showed them to her, and then she had some of her own input. And then a lot of it just came together naturally, like based on what she would do. And then one of the really fun parts is there's a little stepping section to the Missy Elliott Pass the Dutch song. Mm-hmm. And her dad was in a fraternity, and he had a bunch of different step routines. And so we ended up FaceTiming him and asking him to show us some cool step moves from his college days. And so he ended up putting on his boots and his UCLA sweatshirt, and he sent us these tutorials, and we're like, we have to include this in our team. So the choreography is actually from her dad.
Really? Oh, wow. That's so great. So when the gymnasts are on the floor and they're doing this and they're performing their hearts out now, I mean, I just saw the Janet Jackson one that you also choreographed with a different gymnast. There's nobody in the stands. And so how do they get the energy to really, really give it their all to perform, like as if they're performing before a big audience?
Yeah, it's definitely different this year, and we didn't know what it was going to look like going into an arena with no audience, and I've actually been so impressed with the amount of energy that the entire team is able to bring to each other. We all kind of naturally do the choreography with them. That's just something that hypes up the girl that's performing, because they feel like they're not in it alone. But we're just extra full out on the sidelines now, you know, because there's only a small mm-hmm. amount of us. There's not a whole crowd, and usually there's a whole student section that actually learns parts of each of the girls' choreography and does it with them too. I think it's just about like being with the team and celebrating the fact that we still get to compete.
Yeah. Let me ask you about how you integrate the dancing with the gymnastics part. Because oftentimes, like in the past, when you watch the Olympics, it just seems like two separate things are happening. There's the tumbling and all the gymnastics part, and then maybe a little bit of dancing around, but that doesn't seem like most of the gymnasts don't seem to be that into that part of it, but the main part of it is the gymnastics. So how do you make the dancing more integral to the gymnastics?
I think it just starts with kind of setting up a culture that embraces that and encourages it. And when one person's out there on the floor performing their heart out, I think it inspires the other people. And so the whole team is inspired to kind of elevate in this way, at least at UCLA. But it's hard because a lot of gymnasts don't have formal dance training. And if they do, maybe it's, you know, a ballet instructor coming in once a week to work on their turnout and their posture, but it's generally not a whole lot of extra time that you can dedicate to dance, because there's a ton of skills you have to learn. It's all very time consuming already. So it's hard to sometimes like dedicate that. But I think like for athletes who make that a priority, it can definitely be done. And I hope that it's done more and more in the Olympics. I know they have to cram in a lot more tumbling and a lot more leaps and elements and things into their routines. But mm-hmm. yeah, it would be lovely to see that more artistry, I think, just across the board.
Are they scored on that? Are they scored on the dance part?
Yeah, they are. It's like one, I guess, subcategory is the artistry. But I would say more often than not, it's not very commonly deducted, just because it is so common for the athletes to just kind of pose and move through things. And yeah. I hope that in the world of gymnastics, that this can kind of start to build over the years, and that other teams and countries and levels of athletes can start to integrate dance, because I also think it helps with your confidence. Like just in general on the beam and on the floor, especially, but But I think if you're a confident performer, you're going to exude that, and it'll just make everything else come to life, including your skills and your tumbling and your dismount.
Right. So it's kind of an afterthought in a sense. And you wish that it was less of an afterthought and more of a current thought.
Totally. Yes, I would love that. I would love to be, like, you know, given extra points or something for artistry.
Yeah, absolutely. So what about you? Are you still dancing? Because you were a professional dancer for a long time and performed with Beyonce and some other huge performers.
Yeah, I'm still dancing. I'm with an agent, and I work as a dancer and choreographer, along with being a coach for UCLA. Not a whole lot going on right now. I'd say in the industry, it's a bit slow. But, you know, there's still the occasional submissions, which are now done at home or on Zoom. There's not the big auditions. There's not really a whole lot of touring going on at the moment. But I'm still working. I've done a couple shows here and there, choreographed a music video recently. So it's nice that there are still things happening in entertainment. It's just looking a little less busy than it's been.
Well, thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. That's Bejoy Das, volunteer assistant coach for UCLA Gymnastics. And that does it for us today here on Press Play. Thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand, and I'll see you tomorrow.